This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here at New Books in East European Studies, with my guest today, travel writer Mark Baker. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
So we'll get right down to business, a little bit about Mark and his bio. Mark Baker's book is called Chas Pramien, Time of Changes, published by Albatross Books in 2021. He is an American journalist and travel writer. In the 1980s, he lived in Vienna and reported on the former Eastern Bloc for Business International and The Economist Group. In 1991, he moved to Prague, where he worked as an editor for the Prague Post and co-founded the Globe bookstore and coffee house. He's written 30 travel guidebooks for publishers like Lonely Planet and Fodor's on countries in Central and Eastern Europe, including the Czech Republic. This book we'll talk about today, Time of Changes, Chas Pramien, is his first book of historical nonfiction. And for more about Mark, you can find information at his website, www.markbakerprague.com. So I have a lot of questions about the stories that you tell as a travel writer and a journalist, but I'd like to begin with my first question, and that's about your motivation. So what motivated you to write this book, Chas Pramien?
You know, the time frame of the book, as you mentioned in the introduction, concerns the 1980s and the 1990s, the period of transformation. The centerpiece of the book is actually 1989. Half the book is in the 80s, when the Eastern Bloc countries were under communist government. And then the latter half of the book is in those years immediately after the anti-communist revolutions of 1989, the Velvet Revolution, the fall of the Berlin Wall, etc. For years, I've had a stack of notes and photos, as well as a lot of memories, some of the posts that I've written to my blog. And, you know, you kind of wonder what you're ultimately going to do with all of those memories. You know, I realized that it was a kind of special time to be in Eastern Europe, Central Europe, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do, like to process those memories in some way or to try to understand that time. In a different way or in a more cohesive way than you actually do as you're going through it the very first time. So I think part of the motivation was to somehow come to terms with that period, to try to process, if that's the right word, all that material that I had at that time, and to try to recover, some of the stories that would have been lost, or at least lost to me, if I didn't at some point try to write them down as a book.
Yeah, I am curious throughout many of the stories, and we'll talk about some of your characters, including your self-construction, how you ended up, first of all, in communist Czechoslovakia. So how did how did you aspire to become a journalist? And what is your background? This is, I think, going to be very curious for a lot of our listeners who've read your work.
Yeah. I journalists will always tell you that they never had any intention of becoming a journalist. It's something that you just kind of fall into when everything else is kind of taken away, right? There are some people that have this lifelong desire to be a journalist, but I really wasn't one of them. I was motivated. I tell the story. In fact, I began the book with a story that I took when I was an exchange student or a junior year abroad student, might be a better way to put it, in Luxembourg, where my university had a kind of arrangement, you know, where you would spend a junior year there in Luxembourg. And this was in the early 1980s. In 1982, I decided with some friends of mine to take a spring break trip to Eastern Europe across the Iron Curtain. And in fact, we wanted to go for our spring break. We wanted to go to the Black Sea coast in Bulgaria. So we rented a car in Luxembourg and we drove it across the continent, going through Germany, of course, and Austria, and then in Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia, then back out the door through Austria and then back to Luxembourg. And I think that's the very first time. It's going to sound a little bit naive on my part, but it's the very first time that I realized this very strange and unnatural division in Europe between East and West. And mm-hmm. somehow that got something in me, you know, like, what is this weird thing called the Eastern Bloc? Or, as you know, or what is this weird thing about of Western Europe? I don't know what is the weirder one, but I mean, you know, like, what is it, this one continent, two systems, completely different? And that's how I kind of got my start in Eastern Europe. So when I got back to my university, which was Miami University in Ohio, the one in Ohio, you know, I graduated the year after I got back, and then I enrolled at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. Mm-hmm. And there they had a good program in the 1980s on Eastern Europe. I think they still have a good program. But at the time it was a kind of, the Eastern European Institute was kind of, I don't know, like a think tank for cranks and dissidents from Central Europe to kind of hang around. And I got into that milieu a little bit. And, and that basically sent me, you know, this direction to Central Europe after I graduated from Columbia.
Yeah, I'm so interested, and you actually use the description of dissidents and cranks, I guess, as well as academics. It's funny, you know, being around Columbia and the Harriman Institute, seeing people who come in and out. I'm interested in your passing through a lot of different places, and I wonder if you can begin by introducing your book and your collection of stories. So, How did you begin with the characters? Obviously, many of these are people that you met, Czechs and Slovaks and so forth, to construct this series of tales or micro stories. What is the content?
Yeah, what is the construct almost? You know, what is the conceit in a certain sense, I suppose? The idea to actually write this book right here, you know, as I said in the beginning, that it was always kind of in the back of my mind, you know, percolating and stewing, and I had all these papers that I would go through and wonder what I was going to do with. But it was really a Czech editor here in Brno at Albatross who asked me if I wanted to write the book. This was before the coronavirus lockdown, before COVID, right before, actually, a couple months before. And he gave me a pretty open door to do what I wanted with this book. And at the beginning, I really didn't know how I wanted to build out my characters or to construct my narrative, to build out my chapters. And then it was only as I started to write that I realized that the best way to approach this period would be, as I said, to divide it in half, to make 1989 the midway point, and then to focus each chapter on a particular year of my life and of this part of the world, and to integrate some of my own personal impressions and stories with a larger picture of what was going on in the region at the time, and to see if I couldn't build some interesting connection that would keep my readers interested and might, you know, allow me to understand the period a little bit better. You know, so mm-hmm. I was kind of like I was making up this this organizational construction on the fly as I was writing. I didn't actually finish with the idea of the 12 chapters, the introduction, mm-hmm. and the epilogue until a few months before I was actually writing the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will ask you about some of the people in the book as you go through this chronology year by year. I wonder if I might start at the end, asking you a little bit about the Globe bookstore. So this is ultimately your chapter 12, but could you introduce for our audience what it was and how you and your co-founders ultimately in the expat community that was there in 1993 started it?
Right. Okay. Yes, as you're right, that's the very last chapter before the epilogue of the book, and it ends in the years 1993 and 1994. I ended the book, this book, in 1994 because that was the year that I actually left Prague with no intention of coming back. You know, I was done. I'd been in Prague, where I'd been in Eastern and Central Europe for 8 years at that point, and I was ready to head back. About the Globe, I thought that that was a very appropriate way to end the time of transformation because, for me, of course, it marks an endpoint, but I think it also marked a kind of endpoint of the transformation process. The Globe Bookstore and Coffee House was part of that expat invasion, you know, mm-hmm. if you will, yeah. that came who came to Prague starting around 1991, I would say 1992, I and four other partners, so there were five of us, decided what Prague needed was another English language bookstore, but one that would also do used books as well, and that one that could function as a cultural space between the English and American authors who wanted to come to Prague and the people, the Americans, the expats, the English-speaking expats and other expats who were living here, and also Czechs who were, you know, curious about English, were learning English, who knew English, could interact somehow. So that's what that was. It's essentially a bookstore and a coffee house, but in a sense, it's a metaphor. You know, even the word Globe, even the title of the bookstore itself is a metaphor. It was kind of like the place where we all interact somehow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's in what area of Prague, is it Holešovice where it was started? What was the decision there? I mean, how did you decide on that particular area of Prague, as you say, given the other bookstores that were there? What's the story behind that?
Yeah, there were a couple of other English language bookstores. It would be wrong for me to say the Globe was the first. It certainly was not, but it was, I don't know, you know, it sounds self-serving for me to say this, but I think it was the most enduring or the most important bookstore at the time, just for its cultural reasoning. To understand why we chose an outlying district of Prague, it's not in the Prague that the tourists know so well, like Old Town Square or Charles Bridge or something like that, because for one thing, it was almost impossible to rent space back then at that point,
exactly.
because there wasn't a functioning rental market. There was a small privatization process going on. A lot of properties were tied up in court and restitution, and nobody had a place to rent. So we found a place finally where the family who owned the building had recently received the right to rent it out to other people. But the downside was that this was nowhere near the center. This was about, I would say, about 2 miles north of the Old Town Square, well connected by public transportation. But, you know, in our minds, like how are our customers ever going to find us out here? Anyway, we didn't care. You know, we had the property. It was affordable rent. It had two big rooms, one for a bookstore, one for a coffee house. The family turned out not to be so great in the end, but they did have the leasing rights to rent the space to us, and they signed a 5-year lease, and that was important to us. So that's how it started in Holešovice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so interesting to me to see and to hear you reiterate that story because you work for so long as a business journalist, and I see this as at that really, you know, kind of shakedown moment, for lack of a better word. It's while privatization is happening. And that leads me to my next question. I wanted to ask you again, like sort of tracing back to the 80s, 1982, 1983, 1984, the year of Milan Kundera and so forth, if you could introduce some of your characters, because On the one hand, I see you've got an intellectual community, there's a third space, there's this coffee house, and yet you're almost writing, if I can put words in your mouth, a love letter or a love story about, you know, a lot of the people who met at the bookstore, and then a lot of your own friends who were there with you as you were coming of age. So I guess my question for you would be if you could tell us a little bit about your travel companions and how you tell that story.
Oh, that's very interesting. That's the very first time I've ever gotten that question in an interview. I was not alone on these trips to Central and Eastern Europe, and at different stages in my life, you know, I had different love interests, I had different friends, I had different people who went with me along on these journeys. So it's funny, when you write a book, you realize that the persons you're writing about are also going to read the book at some point, you know? And so you really want to be fair to that person, and you want to be fair to that person's contribution to the book. So, you know, I didn't want to write that I had done this and I had done that without also bringing in the people I had done those things with, you know, just to be fair, you know, just to be honest with what was really going on. The book starts out with my best friends from Miami University days in Luxembourg. That would be Doug and Jerry and Sheila. Doug was my best friend at the time. Jerry was a very, very nice guy, conservative Catholic guy. And when I tell that story about how we somehow mistakenly bumbled into a bathhouse in Budapest, he was absolutely shocked, yeah. You know, beyond belief that this was ever going to come back to haunt him someday, you know, when he wanted to run for the governor of Wisconsin or something like that. And then, and then Sheila during that period became my girlfriend, you know, during the course of that trip. So, you know, that's a kind of a special memory for me. I didn't want to really bring that into the book too much because I don't want to get caught up in love stories, you know, I mean, but, you know, that was the background of that trip, you know, in a sense, it really was a coming of age, you know, trip for me in a lot of ways, you know, getting to know Sheila better and getting to know Eastern Europe better. And then each chapter brings in a new character somehow, you know, because at that stage in your life, when you're in college or you're going to grad school or something like that, people come and go out of your life. You don't realize it's not always going to be this way, but people come and go out of your life each year, you know, as you meet new friends or find a new girlfriend or whatever. And then the second story is after I go to Colombia, and it's actually the first story of me coming to Prague. And I put that story in the book because, you know, this book is for Czech readers, and this is the very first time that I actually came to their country, to the Czechoslovakia, but also because it was a crazy story. You know, I mean, I was traveling at the time with my roommate at Columbia who was in Poland to study Polish. So we went up to Krakow first, and then we took the train down here to Prague, and then we got lost. We got separated from each other through a hotel mix-up, and it was a crazy 3 days of searching around Prague, looking for him and wondering what had happened to him. And at the very same time, I had met a girl in Poland while I was there who was coincidentally also in Prague during that weekend. So it was a kind of magical moment for me. You know, I mean, I was falling in love with this Polish woman. And at the same time, I was worried beyond belief of what had happened to my own roommate. So, you know, I won't go through every chapter about that, but just to give you an idea about how, you know, how my side characters or how my main characters are so important to my narrative because, you know, They're the juice, you know, that I'm pushing off of during these chapters.
Yeah, and your chapter two, I think it's a remarkable sort of moment in time. It's called The Case of the Missing Roommate in English. I wonder how it translates and relates in Czech in the original. You're talking about this first visit, which I find really interesting as you go from Luxembourg to Prague, to Czechoslovakia a little bit later. And I guess my impression, you know, reading it, because I read it in English in this case, is as you revisit this 1984, what are your general ways of making 1984 relatable? And I would say this, you know, both for a Czech audience and for an American audience or an expat audience, How do you make the stories as a travel writer relatable? What's your hook?
You know, I think it goes a little bit back to your previous question. The hook is obviously the relationships that I had with the people in those chapters, because those are eternal. You know, I mean, what grad student hasn't gone, you know, abroad and, you know, found a love interest or something like that? It's such a classic story somehow. And that story about missing a roommate, you know, that also is something that anyone can relate to. You know, that, you know, you go through 3 days of your life when your roommate has just disappeared and is vanished in a city. So it's the fear that you feel during that thing that makes that so, I think, relatable to anyone at any time. You know, and then, but I think the question also that you just asked me kind of relates to something that I had to do for the book, because the book is being published in 2021, you know, of course, you know, almost, I hate to say it, but almost 40 years after I lost my roommate in Prague that first time around, or at least
right.
Not quite 40 years, let's not exaggerate, but certainly almost 40 years since I took that road trip to Bulgaria. So I had to try to bring in descriptive elements to try to give people just a sense of what the objective reality on the ground was. So to try to say that the ladies at the travel agency were wearing drab olive uniform color or something like that, just to give people mental image to grasp onto. So, you know, I didn't realize how much descriptive elements I had, how much descriptive writing I would really have to bring into the book. But I realized that if I wanted to make these times real to modern readers, I would have to really try to, you know, paint pictures, you know, of the way things were back then.
Mm-hmm. I see you, Mark, moving through genres. I think there's a lot of mystery writing. And I wonder if you could tell some of these stories. Tell us the story of Arnold. Who was he? And what did you find out about Arnold later? Who was he in your trip to Czechoslovakia?
I really like the remark about the genres, because the book was recently reviewed here by a magazine in Prague called Reflex, and the writer reviewed the book and she said the first thing I had to get my arms around was what genre of book was this really? Is it a travel book? Is it a biography? Is it a history book? Is it a detective story? You know, somehow. So it's kind of like all of those things, depending on the chapter and sometimes even within the chapter. So Arnold is a main character of chapter 3. Arnold came into my life when I moved to Vienna and I started working for Business International. Business International, for your listeners, was a small publishing outfit in Vienna and other places around the world that would write very much how-to books for businessmen about how to do business in challenging parts of the world. Our Vienna office covered Central and Eastern Europe, Yugoslavia, and the Soviet Union. So that was, you know, people would subscribe to our publications. Companies would, like Wrigley's or Philip Morris, or, you know, people that make whiskey or perfume or tires. And they would subscribe to our publications to learn how that they could sell into these very challenging markets. And of course, there was commerce going on between East and West back then, involving Western companies. But the key for Western companies was, how do I get into these crazy markets? So that's what we tried to help them do. It was a consulting business and a journalistic business. Arnold was one of our stringers. Each one of us, we were based in Vienna. We were all Anglophones, pretty much an even mix between Americans and English or Scottish. And we all used people in country. So in Poland, in Bulgaria, in Romania, I don't think we had anybody in Romania when I was there, but in Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia, to help us to make our hotel reservations, to set up our meetings, and to suggest interesting topics to cover. Like, you know, maybe there's going to be more consumer goods imports coming in or something like that. And our stringers were supposed to help tip us off to those things, so that when we did our reporting trips, we had a bit of an advantage. And Arnold was one of these people. You know, Arnold was hired by Business International to be my stringer in Czechoslovakia. He was from Prague, though he was born in Western Bohemia. He lived in Prague when I was reporting there. And it was, as I said, it was his job. He would make my hotel reservation. He would set up all my meetings with foreign trade people, with Czech companies, government officials, and he would drive me around to all my meetings in his car. And then, of course, you know, my Czech was terrible, and he would help translate, he would help translate, right. For me there. The thing that I didn't realize is that Arnold had a second job. And Arnold's second job was to report on me. Everything that I did, everything that I said, every person I met, just basically everything. And, at the time, I had some vague idea that this was happening but I was naive, as I say in the book, painfully naive in places. And I didn't really think about that very much. I only learned about Arnold's second job, let's say, many, many years later in the 2010s. I was in Prague. I was Googling some old names of people I used to know back in the day. I keyed in Arnold's name into Google. I hit return and nothing came up. Nothing. And I went down and down and down in the search results. And I finally came on a very small link to one report by the Prague Military History Institute here in Prague about Arnold. And the title was Arnold, Collaborator, Journalist and Collaborator with the Secret Police. And my blood went cold. And then I read the report and I learned all about Arnold's second life. So that chapter three, is really two stories, me talking about some funny stories that Arnold and I did together about how obviously they must have suspected that I was also a spy if they had put Arnold on me as a spy, let's say. And then the second half of the chapter, second part of the chapter, it's not really a half, but is trying to understand that relationship now, 30 years later, what Arnold's motivations might have been, and borrowing from that report to try to present Arnold. I say in the beginning that this chapter is as much my story as it is his. And I was really interested in trying to explore some of the motivation on the other side and try to deal with my own emotions. Of course, when I found out that he was a spy, I was angry, as angry at my company, angry at him, of course, and angry at me, for not realizing it sooner and doing something about it when I could. So that's chapter three, and that's Arnold.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so interested in how you narrate that, because I think, a lot of the current writing, Back to the Lives of Others, of course, which is a film that I show to my students, but, Catherine Verdery, her book, My Life as a Spy, Sheila Fitzpatrick, who's written a book about this as well, the story of surveillance, and how you go back to look at your life, almost like an autopsy of your life in this period from the 80s through the early 90s. It's so intriguing to me. And I really hope people will read this chapter, both, as a narrative, as you do as a travel writer, and perhaps maybe as a primary source where you're coming back to that self-reflection. I want to move maybe out of Prague a little bit and ask you where else you visited. I know you've been everywhere in Central and Eastern Europe and Southeastern Europe too, but what particular places attracted you? And Brno is a good example within Czechoslovakia or Czech Republic, but where else did you go and why?
I think the very first place that I was really fascinated with and still am to a certain degree is Vienna. The city that I was living in the 1980s from 1986 to, through the end of the decade. I found it to be as difficult to comprehend what was really going on as any city in the Eastern Bloc back then. And I wonder if it's, because of the Habsburg legacy or, how deeply textured that culture is, the Viennese culture is after the centuries. Anyway, I always enjoy going back there, and I still don't have a handle on that city completely. Outside of the Czech Republic, within Eastern Europe, my favorite place to go, if you follow my writing in travel writing at all, is Romania. I write about a trip to Romania that I took with my girlfriend at the time in June 1990. And it also pops up in the very beginning of the book because we traveled on our way to Bulgaria. At the beginning, we traveled through Romania, of course, to get there. And that city, that country, and the city of Bucharest has really fascinated me. I have a hard time pinpointing exactly why, but I think it's all the contradictions in the society, the legacy of the Ceausescu regime, and the deep and lasting impact that that legacy has had on the country, I think till this day. You know, that's one. And then maybe, you know, the other place is Poland. You know, I've written a lot about Poland. I really like Krakow and Warsaw, both of them. And, you know, there's just something about Poland and solidarity that, that attracted me to Eastern Europe right from the start. So that's another one of my favorites, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting that you say that. I mean, I'll just say kind of personally, you know, my father was in Poland in 1984, actually right during the period you seem to have been there. He was on a teacher exchange, and I just remember poring over his notes and looking at his study of Poland and how he visited the Katowice and saw the miners and things like this and the official trips that he was on. It was something for me, at least, that motivated me to go to Poland when I was finally there on my grad student trip from 2002 to 2005. So I find it fascinating how you reflect backwards. And for Romania too, I wonder if you might say a word about this whole issue of moral leadership that you bring up. You know, you mention Ion Iliescu in the book, and you talk about the two Václavs. And you make an argument, I think, which is really compelling about Romania 1989-1990. How do you establish this juxtaposition, let's say, between the moral leadership that is there with Havel and what's there in the transition, if you can call it that, after the Ceausescu's in 1989?
Right. The year 1990 presented a bit of a challenge for me as a writer of this book. I had experiences, of course, in 1990. I was still in Vienna at the time, technically, still working for Business International, but already contemplating a move to Prague, which I did in 91. I came on this to this basic conclusion that 1990 is underrated in terms of history. You know, it was perhaps equally as important as 1989 because the big questions of what was to come after 89 had not yet been fully answered. You know, by big questions, I mean, what would happen to Germany, for instance, divided Germany, or what would happen ultimately to the Soviet Union, which emerged from 1989 still basically intact. And there were just a lot of other questions, big geopolitical questions that had to fall right if 1989 was to be a success, or say a total success. So I decided to devote two chapters to 1990, and one would focus on a trip to Prague that I took in February of that year, which I called the Two Václavs. And I talk about Václav Havel and I talk about Václav Klaus. And it was clear to me that whether you liked Havel or not, and you know, we all did, or whether you liked Klaus or not, and we all did back then, and not many people do now, it was clear that Czechoslovakia was in good hands. You know, they had a moral mm-hmm. leader like Václav Havel, and they had an economic visionary, you know, or one that appeared to be in Václav Klaus, and very determined to take Czechoslovakia west. Romania, which is the second chapter that I write about in 1990, the second chapter focuses on a trip that I took in June of 1990 with my girlfriend at the time to Bucharest. And we were not following events in Bucharest or Romania very carefully back then, but we just assumed because basically, the questions were, you know, 1990 was going well for Czechoslovakia, was going reasonably well for Poland. We just assumed that things must be going reasonably well for Romania as well. But we timed our visit for what Romanians call the Mineriada. It was the weekend that the leader of the country, Iliescu, called in miners onto the streets in Bucharest to try to disrupt and break up student democracy, pro-democracy protesters that were protesting against his rule. So I thought that set up a really interesting case study of two countries in the Eastern Bloc, two countries that, you know, more or less had this, you know, the same but similar experiences in the Eastern Bloc, or at least broadly similar experiences in the Eastern Bloc, but two which perhaps had wildly divergent, at least in the short term, widely divergent outcomes. And that was the reason for writing those two chapters on 1990.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in asking you, and this is, I hope it's not too probing, but I wonder if you could say, maybe as a journalist, what you think you got right. And of course, this is a very subjective, and it's part of the reflection and the blogging that you continued to do later with Radio Free Europe. But, because there's so much blame that goes around and with all the lustration campaigns, were there things you feel like you got right about 1989? Were there things that you felt like you got wrong about 1990 in looking at these two countries and maybe other countries within the Eastern Bloc?
You know, it's a kind of contentious point to my book, because people look back on 1989 and they say, of course, you know, that those revolutions were coming. They were inevitable. You know, the Eastern Bloc was falling behind. That the digital and internet technology was just around the corner. If it hadn't fallen in 89, it would have fallen in 94 or 96. The situation was untenable. It was unsustainable. But what I really wanted to do was, with this book, was to take readers back before 1989 and ask them, could you have really predicted what was going to happen if it was also inevitable now?
Yeah,
and
I see that.
I think the answer is absolutely no way. And I fell into that trap myself. We blithely went into 1989 thinking that the division of Europe into Eastern and Western halves was as normal as the phases of the moon. It never even struck us that this was unusual somehow. You know, it just seems so part of the everyday life. You know, like, do fish see water? You know, did we see the division?
Right.
Did we see the division of Eastern and Western Europe as anything unusual? And so that blinkered thinking led us into doubting that 1989 could have ever happened, you know? And so when you ask me if I got anything wrong, you know, I write about an episode in the book where I traveled to Prague, of all places, in November of 1989, not November 17th when the Velvet Revolution started, but a few weeks before. I think I arrived in Prague on November 1st or October 31st of that year. And my job was to ask ordinary Czechs on the street whether they thought the revolutions whether they thought that any change, political change, was imminent or coming. And I'll tell you what, Stephen, to the last man and the last woman that I interviewed, everyone said, it can't happen here. There's just no way that it's going to happen here. Now, Czechs don't remember it that way. And even when I was writing it,
point.
I started doubting myself, you know, like, was it really like that? Or is that just a kind of a memory that crept in? You know how your memory changes over the years and gets a little bit warped. But that's very clear in my mind. People were like, nah. And go back to that period, say the end of October, beginning of November. We had massive demonstrations in Berlin, just across the border from Prague, you know, and Czechs could see those demonstrations. They weren't able to be hidden from them. They knew what was going on in Berlin. And still, with those massive, you know, demonstrations were going on over there, people still didn't believe that it would happen here in Prague. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to write about that. Of course, you know, I was caught up, as I told you just a little bit before then, that I was caught up in the same kind of thinking, in that same kind of habitual thinking that this won't happen. And that led me probably to my worst mistake in journalism, which I'll just tell you about just in a second, just for a second. In an article that I wrote for our flagship publication called Business Eastern Europe, I think the article was published on November 13th, I wrote the headline something like, Czechs and Slovaks say it can't happen here. So, you know, this was just 4 days before the Velvet Revolution got started. So you might say that was my biggest miss as a journalist.
Well, you're not the only one, Mark.
And, Thank you.
You know, in French journalists reflecting about Le Pen, or American journalists reflecting about Trump, and those things that go on in hindsight, which is really 2020. So,
right,
like, forgive yourself and just cast it into the wastebasket, as you know, journalists will tend to do when they have a throwaway piece that they hope reads.
No, very true.
I'd like, you know, just to continue about sort of, if we can move it up to 1993, if you could reflect a little bit about the expat community. I know in my own mind, I have this stereotype of bad poetry being written in coffee shops, and
Right.
There are, of course, some really good novels and people who come to Prague, as you say, like Allen Ginsberg. It's a very funny story that you tell, or Gary Steingart. But maybe share your own impressions with the demographics and the cultural mores of this community. What was it actually like for you in this period, 91, 92, 93?
You know, this chapter was a very difficult one for me to write because, you know, so much has come out of that, like so much legend has come out of that, or lore has come out of that, you know, that on one side that it was a great party, that expats took over lots of buildings. It was just a lot of fun. There were so many drugs. And if you remember it, then you really weren't there. That kind of the way that people used to look back on the 60s in kind of a calcified, nostalgic way. And then on the other side are the expat haters, the self-loathers who say, oh, mm-hmm. it was nothing but horrible poetry and it was a terrible scene. It was very artificial, blah, blah, blah. So what I wanted to do was just throw all of that out the window, all of it, both sides, and try to look at that, at what happened in a kind of fresh way. What was that all about? Because I'll tell you what, right now, young Czechs and Slovaks, they don't know anything about that time. You know, they really don't.
My editor. Ears.
My editor at Albatross, who's younger than I am, he said when I turned in that chapter and he read it and he came back and he said, Mark, we're going to make history with this book. You know, nobody's ever told this story. And I was like, I don't think we're going to make history with that particular chapter because, you know, it's well known. But what I wanted to do was to recast it. And I found a way to recast it by pairing it with the chapter that comes before it. It's the chapter where I'm working at the Prague Post as the business editor. And I had come up to Prague in 1991. I didn't have anything to do. I'd left my job at Business International, and I was casting around for a job. And I was lucky enough to run into the people who started the Prague Post, and they learned about my experience in Vienna, and they offered me the job as the business editor of the Prague Post. I thought, great, I'm going to do that. And I thought when I first took the job that this was going to just be a fun job. You know, I'm going to be reporting on a country that's just emerging as a new democracy from these decades of totalitarianism. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a feel-good story all the way, blah, blah, blah. And we ran into a train wreck. You know, we ran into a train wreck. The country was having a difficult time coming out of the, you know, the political unions that had led the Velvet Revolution were dissolving into these very, very bitter ideological right. splits. The country was debating on what to do about lustration, about whether to forbid people who had worked in the former regime from holding influential positions of power in the new society. They were debating on what to do economically. You know, how do we privatize our companies? You know, what do we do with our economies? How do we prevent unemployment and inflation? And then finally, what do we do with Czechoslovakia? You know, is this country viable as a country? Slovaks started to slowly want their own state. Czechs started to, you know, were resisting. And it soon became very clear that there was not going to be a meeting of the minds between Czechs and Slovaks on this. So instead of a feel-good story, we came up with a really feel-bad story, which was the split of the country at the end of 1992 and the beginning of 1993. So, you know, don't worry, I'm getting to your expat story, but it comes – oh, yeah. Go ahead.
No, but tell me about that. I'm interested in the communities that you were weaving in and out of.
You're right. So so I found a way to look at the expats in a kind of different way I think there's merit to this approach. The country at the end of 1992 was in a hard spot. It was breaking up. There were a lot of things to be unanswered. But at the same time, all of a sudden, Havel and Prague and Czechoslovakia became very popular among young people all around the world, not just in the United States or in Britain, but in Canada, in Europe, in Australia, everywhere. These new people, young people, they didn't care at all about the political difficulties of the country or the economic difficulties of the country. They were really excited about Prague, about Havel. About the beauty of the city, about the possibility of the future. And it gave a kind of energy, an impulse to the city, you know, an image of being right. cool, you know, of being popular, of being desirable. And I think the city still draws on that image to some degree, even now, even today, you know, Prague is cool, you know, to some degree.
Right.
And I think, and so that's where that, That's where I kind of start the expat story, you know, where the country is in a not in a bad spot, but in a difficult spot, in a gut-wrenching spot. You know, revolutions have consequences, and a lot of those consequences are completely unintended. And I think an unintended consequence was the breakup of the country. And all of a sudden, in 93 and 94 rolls around, and there's thousands of people on the streets, young people from all around the world, starting businesses, starting bars, intermingling with Czechs and Slovaks of that age who have their own clubs. They're starting newspapers, magazines, literary reviews, bookstores, in our case, newspapers like the Prague Post or our rival Prognosis. And there were a couple of other newspapers. At this time, Prague actually supported 4 English language newspapers, if you
can
believe
that. That's remarkable. That's a remarkable part of your story, too. Yeah, I would say, you know, too, Mark, because you have many of the editors who are very, you know, sort of like legendary and charismatic figures like Alan Levy, you know, who died in 2004 included. And I love that part of your story, because it's often, you know, the story of these editors who have a dream, or bookstore owners who have a dream. And they go there, and sometimes their dreams fizzle, and sometimes they last. But that's the part, you know, I hope our listeners realize as they read your book, that there's not a timelessness to this, that actually these things might rise and fall and ebb and flow.
You know, we didn't, at the time, we did not realize that these were not timeless. You know, we thought that these were timeless, rather, you know, to say. I don't think we realized that by the end of the 90s, the beginning of the 2000s, that, you know, that this wave would have more or less been over, fizzled out, and that, you know, this country would be just a normal medium-sized EU country, you know, somehow. You know, it didn't start out that way. It's a really good thing to know. I wish I would have realized how special that was at the time and how potentially short-lived it was.
Mm-hmm. What would you say, and this is really sort of a question for you, a very brief one, I hope, about the profession, that your career freelancing as a journalist would be possible now, let's say, to someone who studies at Columbia or studies at Miami University or wherever, learns a little bit of Czech, goes, you know, and hopes to make it there? Would there be any word or words of advice that you would give to someone who's kind of dreaming of this as a possibility?
You know, there are still dreamers, you know, who come to Prague. I run into them, you know, here and there. But there aren't those self-made outlets anymore. You know, I don't think people are coming here. I could be wrong. You know, I'm older now. I'm not in touch with what people are coming in when they come in right off from the plane. But my sense is that that infrastructure, you know, doesn't exist to the extent that it did. You know, I don't see people coming here and starting literary magazines, you know, or bookstores, mm-hmm. something like that.
Mark, since we're winding down a little bit with our time now, I wonder if you might suggest to our listeners here at New Books Network some of the writers and books, perhaps, that they might read or people to follow.
Well, the first thing I want to do is to draw your listeners attention to the series of the 1980s that was edited by Philip Roth. It was originally published by Penguin Books in the United States. It was called Writers from the Other Europe. And it's a survey edited by Philip Roth with, you know, introductions by some weighty intellects, you know, from the day, but it included writers from not just Czechoslovakia, but Poland, Yugoslavia, and Hungary, and perhaps a couple of other writers from other countries. But it was really an encapsulation of the best writing available in English from those times. And the books are marvelous. They still hold up to this day. A couple of other recommendations is a travel writer. You know, I'm really drawn to these old long form travel books by the great English writers or the great European writers from the past. And one of my favorite writers is Patrick Lee Fermor, who wrote that trilogy from the 1930s when he was a young man. It begins in Holland and he moves across Central and Eastern Europe and he ends up in Istanbul. The second book of the trilogy is called Between the Woods and the Water. It begins where Slovakia meets Hungary. It goes through Budapest and then it moves into, at the time, was part of Hungary, Transylvania, or rather recently part of Romania, but still very dominated culturally by Hungary, and then all the way down to the Danube River near the current Serbian border. And it's just a beautiful evocation of life in the 1930s in that part of the world. It's fantastic.
I haven't read that. Thank you for those suggestions. Mark, you're too modest to admit it, but your guidebook is still read today, and one can find it in shops. I know, actually, I have a copy of it. So,
no way. Which guidebook really, are you talking about?
This is the one from, I think it's 91.
91, so this is the, yeah.
Yeah, this is the seminal text that uh-huh. you became so known for. And I started collecting these Lonely Planet guides for Russia, Ukraine, when I was taking my first trips as a grad student. I'm a little bit younger than you are, but I was going in 99 and 2000.
Right.
After 9/11, then wound up in doing my research through Eastern Europe, through Central and Eastern Europe, and fleeing from boring Vienna to interesting Prague occasionally as well, although I love both cities.
How interesting.
Congratulations to you on this book. I wonder, as a final question, and this is the last 90 seconds to 2 minutes, if you could plug any current projects that you might be working on, things that you might be writing and interested in.
Well, I'm actually learning about what happens to a person after they write a book. I'm right now I'm busy trying to promote the book locally here in the Czech market, doing what I can, possibly thinking about doing a second book for the Czech market, but sort of similar to what I'm doing here, but more up to date, modern take of the funny parts about this culture. What I would really like to draw your reader, to your listeners' attention to is my blog, which you gave at the beginning of the thing. And that's where I put what I'm doing at the moment. And I'm rebooting it and adding some new stories all the time. And the 30th anniversary of the foundation of the Prague Post happens this October. And I'm going to excerpt the English chapter of that chapter on the Prague Post for my blog. So look at it there. And I think that's, I think that's going to be fun for readers who can't get the book now because it's in Czech, but just to see what might be in it.
Fantastic. And you will leave it to someone else to write the biography of Václav Klaus? You talk about this. It's very funny.
I'm good at inventing. I'm good at inventing characters, but I don't think I can do that one,
He's a tough soul.
Yeah. I think he's a very interesting guy. I see it from the cultural detachment. I'm not so emotionally invested in the guy. So I see that his flaws and perhaps his good points where many people here simply see his flaws,
Well, thank you. And I hope our listeners will look up www.markbakerprague.com. I've been speaking here today on New Books Network with our guest, Mark Baker, the travel writer and American journalist. And his book is called Čas promien, Time of Changes. It's published by Albatross Books 2021. Thank you, Mark, again, for your time today and for such a lively interview. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, I did too. It's my pleasure.
And I'm your host, Steven Siegel, here at New Books Network. Until next time.